Now it is my pleasure to welcome you to the session on PI Connect Live Research Forum. The morning session will be moderated by Dr. Kathleen Sullivan. Dr. Sullivan is a professor of pediatrics and the chief of the Division of Allergy and Immunology at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She needs all of these introductions here. I'm sorry, member of the USIDNet Steering Committee, Principal Investigator, Vice Chair of the IDF Medical Advisory Committee, and a PI Connect Principal Investigator, and also, to boot, a member of the IDF Board of Trustees. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Sullivan.
So that seems silly because it's really all about all of you, not about me at all. So I'm just going to start off by saying there are no rules here. We've never done this before. The vision is an interactive dialogue about issues related to patients. We have three patients here who are going to synopsize some issues that have come up in the PI Connect blog. So we've got Brian Rath, we've got Colleen Brock, and we've got Terry Halper. We also have three physicians here, Ken Paris, Ramsey Fulahan, myself for the moment, but we believe Sergio Rosenzweig will be the third one in a minute. Obviously, I can't count or I can't, something. But I also want to point out that PI Connect has a very robust patient governance board. And this is really sort of the guiding force that helps us all interrelate together. So PI Connect is meant to be a community. It's meant to be a forum where patients, researchers, clinicians, nurses, anyone with an interest in primary immune deficiency can come together. And in that spirit, that's how this is going to work today. So the three patients are going to synopsize the threads that people have been blogging about. Then we're going to have some of the physicians have a few comments, and then we want to try and get a dialogue going with all of you to know what your pressing issues are, and then use the physicians on the panel to try and let you know where research is going, what do we know, what do we think the opportunities are that are out there. So with that, I think we're going to start with Brian, to my right, who's going to synopsize a thread for us that came from the PI Connect blog.
Thank you, Dr. Sullivan. There was a posting on the PI Connect blog by a researcher who had posted an article, or a journal article from Europe, which talked about the study of stem cell transplants in CVID patients. Now, Dr. Sullivan, we sat in a hyper-IgM syndrome talk where we as patients listening to you talk about hyper-IgM syndrome, and stem cell transplants, bone marrow transplants, those are things that in the hyper-IgM community are relatively common and are very relatively successful. In the CVID community, it's a new era. Can you talk about what's out there for these kind of transplants in the CVID community?
Yes, thank you, Brian. The stem cell transplantation really was a big advance for patients with severe combined immune deficiency. These patients will not survive if they don't treat it beyond 1 or 2 years. And slowly, we started to advance the patients for other diseases. The Sub-Holler syndrome, Ekman hyper-IgM, there's a big perception is that active hyper-IgM patients can survive for a pretty long period of time, but beyond 20, 30 years of age, they're very few.
I'm 42 here, so without a transplant.
They are in the question, and the transplantation has immediate potential side effects or fatality. And so you get into the question, is it worth taking the risk and potentially getting a cure? And those are very hard, I don't have an answer to that, those are very hard decisions. So CVID is, I guess, the newest condition where transplantation can be considered. Many CVID patients do really well, others have complications that are frustrating, not first for the patients and then the physicians. The trial that is described in Europe started with patients who have significant complications. So those are the ones where it might be worthwhile. Survival rate was 48%, but those who survived resolved their problems. At the beginning, it's probably not for everybody with CVID. We know with severe combined immune deficiency, other conditions, the healthier you are, the better the outcomes from stem cell transplantation. But in other conditions, you take the risk when you're doing relatively well. I don't know if you have, I don't know if anyone else wants to comment.
Can I ask a question? I guess because of the CVID is variable, because of the variables in CVID, so many
first upcoming long-term survival. I think we need more information for the PI. But with anything in university, if it's finding the patient's family choice, they have to make a decision. I think our job is to provide the information to the benefits. And for different people, some people really want to cure early on, and that's very important for them. Others are afraid to take this. And I think it's a personal decision for the patient and the family.
Let me just pick up on something that Ramsey said a few sentences ago. 20 years ago, all that we transplanted was SCID. Today, routinely, we transplant about 5 different diseases, and we don't really know what it's going to look like 5 years from now. Will it be 20 diseases? Will it be 50 diseases? We don't really know what that trajectory is going to be. I just want to emphasize that this paper on transplantation for common variable, there was a 50% mortality rate. That's not very good. Not many people would step off the end of that saying that there's a 50% chance I'm going to come out of this at the end cured. That's not so different than where SCID started 20 years ago. So we may get to a point where transplantation for common variable is routine, but at this point, it's probably not there. Having said that, I'd like to ask all of you, how many of you have raised the issue of transplantation with your physician? Just asked if it was possible, sort of just opened the door for that dialogue. Not so many. Having now heard some of this, are there others of you that would be interested in having a dialogue just to sort of, again, open the door and understand what the landscape is? I think it's, not so many, but I think that's, it's never a mistake to have that conversation. And just because the state of the art right now today is 50% mortality for transplantation for common variable, by the way, it's much better for hyper-IgM, much better for SCID, doesn't mean that that's where we're going to be 5 years from now, but it's never a mistake to open that door and have that dialogue. Yep. The question is, what does a transplant consist of? Ramsey, you want to take that?
Sure. So, first, it's important to find the donor who would be a good match to provide the stem cells. It could be a sibling. Those are the best. The match rate of the donor would usually have the least risk of graft versus host disease. There are very close matches from unrelated donors, and many of them do very well. Now, I'm talking about, we don't have a lot of experience with the IE, so the other condition that we do transplantation. Different centers have different approaches. But other than severe combined immune deficiency, most centers will use some form of chemotherapy to prepare the bone marrow, to get rid of T-cells in the donor stem cells that might cause what we call graft-versus-host disease. That's probably the biggest concern. That's when the donor cells recognize the host patient as foreign and mount an immune reaction. Most forms of acute graft-versus-host disease are not very severe, they're treated deadly. When you get chronic graft-versus-host disease, as the word implies, it's a long-term condition and it causes a lot of morbidity, infections, and causes mortality. So some people will use chemotherapy to wipe out the bone marrow completely, others use abusive density conditioning. The risks and benefits for both. And even in severe combined immune deficiency, we're trying to figure out what's the best approach. And right now, we're studying that what everybody does, but soon we'll start doing comparison protocols to determine that. So for CBID, it's obviously a way down the road. And then there's some degree, there's about 6 months of immunosuppression to prevent graft versus host disease. That usually lasts about 6 months and then patients can come off of it. In the meantime, while patients on CBID will be getting gamma problems, so hopefully you can come off gamma problems with the bone marrow.
No, excellent.
I'm sorry, can you break it down? Can you break it down? What's the actual transplant like for the patient or for the donor? How the cells harvested and how are they given to the donor?
stem cells can be taken from bone marrow, correct, and which involves general anesthesia and a lot of pokes into the bone marrow to withdraw enough stem cells. Or the donor is given medication, GCSF, which actually mobilizes the stem cells from the bone marrow and then releases the cell. So the GCSF may cause some bone pain, but then it releases the cell. Or young children actually do this for their siblings, maybe relatively quite well with it. In kids, we can use cord blood as a form of stem cells. Cord blood has a limited amount of stem cells, so for an older child or an adult, there probably isn't enough in cord blood. So I would think that wouldn't be a good option for CBIT. Not that we have a lot of experience, but so those are the sources of the stem cells. Depending on how much chemotherapy is used, if you use full dose chemotherapy, there's a period of risk for infection, there's a period where you can not receive transfusions. Reduced intensity is a shorter period of time, less need for transfusions. You have a better chance of engraftment, meaning donor stem cells getting into the bone marrow with more chemotherapy you use.
I have a question for the audience now. So we've heard at the moment for some of the diseases where transplant's not currently available or maybe advised, despite hearing what seems like difficulties now, how many who aren't currently available for transplant, despite the difficulties, would still consider the risks that you've heard? Could you raise your hands, please? Right, so I'm going to ask someone to put you on the spot and ask you, why is that? Why would you take those risks?
Just to give my daughter a better quality of life. She's so young and to have to go through IG therapy at a rate of every 2 weeks, which she's getting right now,
right,
isn't a way to live at such a young age.
Sure. Who else had their hand up?
Because I have too many reactions with my IVIG every month. I have fibromyalgia, so I don't know if sub-Q would be something that would be, that I'd be able to do. With fibromyalgia, I'm in so much pain that if I do the needle, it might be even worse. So I'm kind of like on a battleground on what to do.
And how about one more? Someone else had their hand up?
I have natural killer cell deficiency, and it's unclear right now whether it's caused by a GATA2 mutation or not, but I do have some declining blood cell populations as well. And, so I'd be interested. It would potentially be curative. I'm not really sure how to manage my condition right now because there aren't guidelines published yet. So if I could, I'd actually like to ask a question as well, which is how should a patient who is interested in a transplant pursue that interest?
Yeah, transplants are not as advanced for adults as they are for kids. Actually, adults tolerate transplants a lot less well than children do. So it's a much harder equation for adults. Ramsey talked about sort of the mechanism of doing a transplant. What I tell people is you're going to give up a year of your life, and you're not going to be very happy during that year of your life. And so it is a big undertaking, and adults in particular tend to have more adverse events related to it and less good outcomes compared to kids. So it's a much more difficult challenge for adults to get a transplant. So I think that's really important to recognize, and that probably contributes to some of why the common variable outcome was not as good as what we see for SCID, because adults just don't tolerate the transplant process as well. Are there any other questions related to transplant, or should we move on to another topic? I know there's always more questions, but all right. Our next topic is fever, which is something we can all relate to. Sergio's not here. Richard, would you be willing to summarize the thread that came out of the PI Connect blog about fever? Do you have that?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a great one.
Sorry, I should introduce Richard Lowe, who joined us after the original introductions, and Lisa Kobrinsky also joined us.
So there's been a very interesting thread on PI Connect, and it's something I've been following closely. And the thread is related to fever and temperature. My experience is personally as a CBID patient, there were certainly some CBID mentions in this thread, but I think it is a broad concern for anyone with PI, and that is running a fever. How do fevers manifest themselves? A lot of people in the PI community cite the concern is that when you present yourself in a quote-unquote not well state to a physician, your primary care physician, whoever it is, you happen to see an ER doctor, and here you come 98 points into you're just fine, and now you're listening to my ear, not here so much. Well, if you're running a baseline temperature, that actually could very well be a fever in the beginning of an onset of something that for us can become quite serious. But there is not great education if you don't know around that. So the question for me really is there a link between primary immunodeficiencies and potentially lower than average body temperatures that can mask when we start to actually have some kind of infection that would cause us to have an elevated temperature or fever that presents itself as normal fever for normal body temperature. So that's the conversation, and you can definitely dive in and get our opinions. So let's tackle it here.
Okay. So Ken and Lisa, do you have comments about fevers and what qualifies as a fever, and especially if your resting body temperature is low, how do you tackle that?
Facial pain and fever. And sinusitis in my practice is probably one of the most frequent infections that we see in patients. And you really have to have a heightened awareness and treat those usually with a lower threshold rather than waiting for patients to complain of facial pain and fever.
So let's try and take a little poll here. So how many people think that their resting body temperature is below what we would consider average? Actually, the majority. You know, this is not a piece of information that's out there. And it does, you know, in this blog, it was clear that it was a significant challenge for people. If you show up in an emergency room and you're at 100, but your resting temperature is 3 degrees below that, no one sort of takes it seriously. I think it's actually a hugely important piece of information to get out there. And I have to say, I would not have known it without this blog. Definitely a lot more to learn out there. There are some comments.
Well,
or questions?
It's kind of both. I don't know if I ever run fevers or not, but I wake up sopping wet. And a lot of it may simply be menopause. Obviously, this isn't relevant to the men, but there have been a lot of women here who are... What?
I do, too.
Really? See, that's interesting.
Well, this is all about sharing.
Well, but that does get me back to, am I ill or am I going through what every woman goes through at a certain point in her life?
I don't have an answer for that, but I have to say, in my experience, patients always know before doctors do if they're having a serious medical problem. So if someone calls me up and says, you know what, it's just not right, it's, you know, things aren't happening in the way that they should, you know, I always pay attention to that because you know your body better than any doctor is ever going to. So I think that some of those softer signs that are hard for doctors to measure are actually really important. That intuition about what's going on, I think, is, although we can't tap into it and metricize it, I think it's really important. A couple more comments?
I would like to see some kind of a paper written on this because my son and I both tested positive for H1N1 with no fever. You know, we both had chronic sinusitis, bronchitis, all the fun things with no fever. Neither one of us have ever run a fever. Our normal is 96.7. You present in an emergency room at 96.7 and they're going, there's no way you have H1N1. So we have no kind of information to take and say, here's this. I can tell you, we will not run a fever. Please do not base the fact that we have no fever on the fact that we don't need any testing.
So I'm going to challenge you all a little bit. So how many of you are in PI Connect? How many of you are making your voice heard already? Actually, a small minority. You, who I just met, this is a way to get your voice heard. If you put your information into PI Connect, we're going to, I pledge to you that we will actually collect that and write a paper on low body temperature. Chris Galchunes, who's running around with a microphone, is actually the co-PI with me of the next set of the PI Connect, the next iteration of PI Connect. And we would love to write a paper on that. But we actually need, not just want now, we need information from all of you. Look at the hands that went up in this room. It was 80% at least, and that is not a piece of information that's out there. So I am actually going to challenge you, sign up for PI Connect, put that in there, and I pledge to you that if you do that, we will write a paper.
There are researcher comments. There's researcher participation in here, and so it's already active in terms of this being a researcher patient dialogue. So let's really do that and elevate that conversation.
And maybe we'll just take a split second here to thank the physician engagement committee, who's listed on this slide. Yeshim Dimmerdag, Artemio Yonko, Brian Kelly, Andrew Nichols, and Joyce Yu do a lot of the commentary that you read on the blog for those of you that are already in PI Connect. They actually do an amazing job of trying to give feedback, so I just want to give them credit. They put in a lot of time and energy to make this blog interactive and useful to people. More comments? Oh, sorry. Interesting. Did you have a comment?
Well, I was going to say, when I read the blog, I felt validated because I have always known that as a 16-year-old and a 20-year-old, their normal temperature has been 97 and 97.2. So when they're running 99, 99.8, 100, most doctors just kind of like tail off and they're not really running fever. Well, actually, their normal is 97. So when I read that there was a greater population of people with CVID, especially that had that fever, I said, yeah, cool. And I too would be fascinated to find out really how many are out there that have this, and then how we address it with physicians and get them to take it seriously.
A few more comments? Yep.
So I have a question on the other side. What does it mean when a PI patient does run a fever of like 103, like it related to flu? And then we couldn't even get treatment for Tamiflu at that time, even from the immunology office. So that, I mean.
And I do generally run low, and I did run that fever of 103 and have trouble with treatment.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm surprised. Most immunologists are pretty respectful when their patients run a fever. I'm sorry you haven't had a positive experience. There's another question.
More,
I have a nine-year-old, and his normal body temperature is 96, 97. If he's running 98, 99, I have to argue with the nurse. And normally there's a problem. He has some kind of under sinus infection, upper respiratory infection. But when you bring him in and they take his temperature, they're like, his temperature is normal. And I'm like, it's not.
Not
That's
for him.
Not a normal temperature for him.
Yeah.
And normally he's sweating day or two before in his sleep, which happens on occasion. So I thought it was just his body. I had no idea that they had other people, you know, in this community that were experiencing the same thing. So,
you know, Ken probably has the most experience with sinusitis of anyone in the room, and I always look to him for advice. It's insanely hard to diagnose. And I say this as someone who's been out there trying to diagnose this. There's no consensus guidelines. There's no great way to diagnose this. So when someone comes in with a low-grade fever and you're trying to suss it out, how do you handle that?
So I think Lisa mentioned this, and maybe people didn't hear it, but in our practice, sometimes we measure some inflammatory markers. So we might do a CRP, which is a marker for inflammation, which often is elevated when somebody has an acute infection, like a sinusitis or another lower respiratory tract infection. We go based upon symptoms, and in our patients with PI who have a body deficiency and are prone to these infections, we empirically treat them with antibiotics and for a slightly longer course in order to eradicate the infection, because we know that they might need, instead of the usual 10-day course of Augmentin or other antibiotics, they may actually need 3 weeks or four or even longer on an antibiotic in order to completely eradicate an infection. So we treat patients a little bit differently because they're lacking the ability to clear out infections in the mucosal surfaces.
I see
again,
a few.
Globulin doesn't necessarily prevent sinusitis. That's the biggest problem.
Yeah. Huge problem, I agree. There's a few more questions and comments.
We have another question from the audience, too. How can we be sure that there's so many methods of taking temperature? How can we be sure that that way is correct and that that's accurate?
Tough question. Ken, I saw your microphone go up. I applaud you.
So I'll be the brave one to take this on, because I think a lot of physicians up here have been hesitant to say that. So measuring body temperature is very and most of the ways that people measure body temperature at home or even in clinics doesn't accurately reflect your core body temperature. And so patients who feel that their core body temperature is lower than normal, one of the most common reasons for that is that it's being taken improperly or in a location where it's normally lower than 98.6, right? So axillary and forehead and all of these different temperature measurements are notoriously inaccurate, okay? So that's why a fever is something, according to the guidelines that physicians and nurses and healthcare providers have, is anything over 100.4 or above 101. So you may feel more ill with a temperature above 100, and that may represent for you that you have an infection, but technically, I don't usually call that a fever, okay? I don't disregard it, but it's difficult sometimes to call that technically a fever.
Yeah, if, you know, when we get trained on what's a fever, there's criteria saying when you take the temperature mentally under the arm, in the mouth, with symptoms, and that's what these people go by. But I think at the end of the day, the message is that the body temperature is not the thing you're treating. You need to treat a condition. If you have what you feel is a change in your normal body temperature, but you feel fine, I'm not going to treat that temperature. There's nothing there to treat. You treat a condition, not
So I want to take, if I can, two more questions from the audience, but I have a question, if it's okay, for our patient researchers in the audience and then our researchers over here, if I can, real quick. So we're talking a lot about temperature here. What if, would the patient researchers in the audience be willing to participate in something where they could track their body temperature? If we get together and agree on a way to do that, that's time-stamped in an easy way. Maybe you could do it in some type of app on your phone, which I happen to have here. You can easily track that, date-stamped along with your infections and things like that, time of the year. You've got your gender and age in there. Would our patient researchers be willing to participate in something like that with a show of hands?
Woo!
Great. What do you guys think about that up here?
That would be an amazing treasure trove.
Absolutely. We'd all agree on some type of uniform specific, even if it's everyone uses in the specific thermometer or tool, and we distribute that, and the patients use it, and we agree that they'll track daily, whatever it is, their temperature. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But together, as patient researchers and researchers, I think we could do that. Right? What do you guys think? Yeah? All right, we had a question here. Thank you.
I guess it's more of an observation, and there's a caveat on this, and maybe I'm being proud of my condition, but Wiscott's one of the stranger PIDs because of its weird combination of, and I'm a very strange Wiscott. I've lived 45 years past my warranty with no marrow transplant or anything, but as far as the night sweats, when I was younger, my temperature would typically run 97 consistently, and now for the past 15 years, it's probably 98 and so. But as far as the night sweats are concerned, for at least two decades, I have been soaking my T-shirts at the least, and sometimes my... And finally, my physician wife, who has been bugging me for a long time to check my sleep patterns, I finally went for the sleep test, and it was an agony. And I resisted putting the mask on overnight for another year, but I'm finally doing it, and I have noticed my sweat at night seems to have gone away.
No kidding.
At least it's a lot less, and I think the times that I do still sweat, and in fact, my daughter points out in the room the other night, they've been claiming I've been snoring all these years. But anyway, she said I was snoring and the mask wasn't working, but I noticed the next night it had slipped again. And so I think the sweats I'm having now are related to the mask not staying in place and me not sleeping right.
That's a fascinating observation. I've never heard of that connection.
I think we have one more over here. Lady on the aisle here. You had a question?
Christopher pretty much addressed the comment that I was going to make. In one of the larger Facebook groups, probably about 8 months ago, the fever post came up, and it's the most comments I've ever seen on a post. I don't know if any of you remember it. There were probably around 500 to 600 of the 1,600 members were positive about having subnormal temperatures and how it impacts us as far as treatment. I can say for me personally, if 96 to 97 is my normal, I can be in the hospital severely ill for a month and I will never show a temp. And there was actually a European researcher that was a part of our Facebook group that proposed exactly what you all said, and they were going to try to find a supplier, one of the companies, to provide thermometers so that we all shared the exact same thermometer and did it at the same time of day. But I think they had trouble finding a sponsor to do. But I think that would be so interesting to see the research.
Just a quick comment on that, and this is for all of us, there are several now got to get into PI Connect and start having those conversations there. So there's a lot of information that's spread this way. People from stadiums going forward. What we need in the next 24 hours, really in the next 2 years, so by the time we get to Anaheim, things are great. We need those dialogues to happen this way, and the audiences and with your peers on Facebook, wherever. We need to drive those conversations into PI Connect. Absolutely critical for us to get people's eyes and ears and time focused on these conditions.
Beautifully said. And with that, I think we'll transition to our third topic, which is something everyone can relate to, I think, prophylactic antibiotics. We're going to do another one first. hopefully many people will connect to this one. So this is picking the right immunoglobulin replacement treatment, trying to balance side effects and optimizing delivery. And Colleen Brock is going to summarize the threads related to this. This is one of the more active threads. Of course, there's no one recipe that's right for every person. But I think Colleen is going to summarize some of the concerns and issues that rose up, and then Ken Paris is going to talk about at least some approaches that to give at least a little context for making a decision.
There were two that were very active, as Dr. Sullivan said. One was switching from IVIG to sub-Q, and I think you could also reverse that. Those that have been on sub-Q and are changing back to IVIG or changing to IVIG. The second one was alternative administrations, being things that are in the research stages, some of them very early, some of them a little further along, and to alternatives that may be coming that wouldn't require a stick. I talked to a lot of parents of children who are newly diagnosed about IVIG and sub-Q, and which is best, and which should you do. And as I tell most of the parents, it is a lifestyle choice, and it is a choice that you and your doctor need to really talk about which one is best for your child. Talking about children first, I encourage you to have a dialogue with your child. Research exactly how sub-Q works, that the injections are done. You get a small amount of teaching, and then you are expected as a parent either to do it to your child and put the needles in and run the treatment, or your child is expected to work, depending on the age, to do it themselves. And that has to be something that you are comfortable with. You as the sticker, or your child as the one sticking themselves. As an adult, it's your choice. Can you handle sticking yourself? There are a lot of people with needle phobia. They don't want to watch. They want to turn their head. They want to have another person do it. And a lot of insurance companies will not cover a nurse to do sub-Q. They will force you to learn it, and then you're on your own. The nursing staff is there as a backup, but most of the time you are to do it. Sub-Q is run every week, although I learned yesterday, talking to one of the companies, they now have a new product that is every 3 weeks. So there are some changes coming to sub-Q. Again, it's research, it's talking. IV, it can be 2 weeks to 4 weeks. It's one time. As Dr. Sullivan knows, my children will not discuss sub-Q. They prefer IV, but again, it was their choice. It's their body, and I allow them to make the choice. There are certain products. That's where your doctor you have to have a dialogue with your physician as to which product is best for you, depending on the other conditions you may have, whether you have high blood pressure, whether you have diabetes, because all of these products are not made the same. Some have higher salt concentrations, some have higher sugar concentrations, so you really need to be educated on what is best for your body. You can switch. It is not complicated to switch. Normally, if you're switching from IV to sub-Q, you usually start the sub-Q a week after you finish your dose of IV. Not exactly sure how it works, it's the opposite way, as we've not switched. But I do tell people to look at the lifestyle, the choices. I have had parents who have done sub-Q and started to have children who rebelled and have flat out said, I want you to be my mom, not my nurse. And everybody became an issue. You have children who are in college who did sub-Q or did IV. They pushed to sub-Q. They were on their own. They wanted to do it in their time, not somebody else's time. So there's a lot of variety of factors that come into it. The one thing that I will encourage is don't be forced, or don't feel like you're forced into wanting to be better. It's your body, it's your choice.
So I realize there was a whole session on immunoglobulin delivery, and since Ken has proven himself to be brave, I'm going to push you a little bit on topical applications, oral, intranasal, eye. Can you talk a little bit about where we're at with that?
So I can talk a little bit about some of them, understanding that the research on a large scale really isn't there yet for some of the alternative application methods. What researchers and immunologists have been trying to do is think about using immunoglobulin, which is a precious product, right, in ways that may help patients with very specific local infections. So the goal hasn't really been to use these as a substitute for IVIG or subcutaneous IG, but to be able to harness the power of immunoglobulin, either IgG or even IgA, which is also produced in the process of making immunoglobulin by the manufacturers, in alternative ways. And so one of the ways was oral immunoglobulin. And I'm not aware of a large-scale study in the use of oral immunoglobulin, but many physicians, our center included, I know Ramsey mentioned her before, I asked him specifically if he had any experience with oral immunoglobulin. Many centers had a few cases where a special patient who had a chronic infection with a viral illness like rotavirus or norovirus was able to be treated by drinking immunoglobulin, right, to try to help to eradicate that chronic GI infection. And in some cases, it seemed to work. In our case, at our center, we had a teenage boy who had long-term diarrhea from rotavirus, and we were able to get him clinically well by the use of oral immunoglobulin over the course of a couple days. Other case reports have been out there in regards to quote research. These are just case reports. These aren't really well thought through studies that prove that this treatment was effective in all patients, but case studies of the use of immunoglobulin via the oral route that was effective. On the other hand, there are case reports which have shown that it didn't work for certain patients, right? We've always thought about using immunoglobulin via the intranasal route, because many patients with immune deficiencies don't make IgA. IgA is very important in preventing infections within the nasal mucosa, within the sinus cavity, and even in the lower respiratory tract. So if we could harness IgA, we might be able to manufacture some form of a topical application that would decrease the rate of infection. And I'm sure all the people in the audience would be interested in that, as long as it's not invasive. But we need to think that through and try to come up with a study and get a partnership with a pharmaceutical corporation that would allow us to do that type of a study. And I already see a question in the audience.
Come with Mike. Hold on, I'm a little late.
Is there a nasal spray available?
So I'm unaware of a nasal spray that is available. I did hear yesterday from a colleague about a company that is doing some research in manufacturing something to do with the secretory component of IgA, meaning that they're looking at a possibility of harnessing that property of IgA to use on a clinical basis. But for widespread use, it's not out there yet. The research hasn't been done, which is sort of the purpose of this forum, is to discuss that and see if that's...
So has anyone ever used immunoglobulin in a way that's not IV or sub-Q? Has anyone taken it orally? Has anyone tried applying it to your eyes, your nose? Some people just try things unilaterally. It's not prescribed. They just say, what the heck, let's give it a go. So I'm just curious. And as I said, patients always ahead of doctors. So just curious, anyone in the audience that has tried an unusual topical application?
You've treated my son with oral IVIG, and it really did eradicate his stomach viruses. He was very lucky. I believe we did it three different times. He had chronic gut issues, and then you couple that with back-to-back stomach bugs, he couldn't recover. So he was hospitalized for quite some time, and they used it successfully in my son.
I've tried it 3 times. I'm pretty convinced it worked in 2 out of the 3, but as Ken points out, that, you know, that's still not enough to make a conclusion from. We would need to collect folks across the country and try and get a larger data set. More questions?
And this isn't about that. This is something different. But as far as like where you're doing your infusions, as far as what body parts, is there a better body? Like, I'll use my stomach, and then we'll switch to the thigh every couple of weeks to make it easier, or to, because they say to move it. But is there really a need to keep moving it? We kind of had this discussion amongst ourselves. Another point.
Some people get some scarring if they use the same site repeatedly, but if you're not one of those people, there's no reason to force yourself to rotate if you don't like rotating. I find that people are really possessive about the sites that they like. And so, you know, some folks are pretty resistant. But technically, if you can pinch an inch, you can inject there. So some people like arms. I personally am not an arm kind of gal. And to my surprise, when I needed to do self-injection, I picked stomach. I would have thought that that would have been very squeam-inducing, but I actually kind of liked it. So maybe like isn't the right word, but you know what I mean. So that's sort of the rule. But you don't have to rotate. If you're not getting scar tissue, don't fret about it.
Hi. I have selective IgA deficiency. That's the only thing I have. And I'm on prophylactic antibiotics, which in turn give me fungal infections. I have had fungal infections on my skin, in my mouth, in my esophagus, and I don't know what to do. I mean, I don't know any other treatment that is available.
Well, that one's too hard for me. So, but Ken, once again,
I got one more thing to say. Wait a minute. I got one more thing to say. And I have a CPAP machine, but I've had to quit using it because of the moisture that gets on my face. I get fungal infections on my face.
Interesting.
Okay, that's all I have to say.
Interesting. Okay. There's probably some tweaks where you could, like, I think there's probably some tweaks that you could do to minimize that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Moisture is going to foster a fungal infection. I have heard of that before. It's not a common thing, but there are usually some tweaks to the mask that you can do to help out with that. We've got some more comments.
Have there been any case reports using the oral immunoglobulins to treat C. diff?
Ooh, C. diff specifically. Ooh. I remember viruses, physicians. Yeah. Although there is evidence to support that antibodies do play a role in C. diff eradication. So that's an excellent question. I personally, and it sounds like, since I'm seeing shaking heads, that no one else up here has seen literature on that. But, you know, it doesn't mean it hasn't happened. Sometimes people will try things and it just doesn't get published.
So if I would go on the PI Connect and bring that up, would that be something that's research worthy? I mean, is that something that you see a lot of?
It's definitely research worthy. C. diff, I bet if I ask for hands, about a third of the audience will put up their hands. So it's definitely research worthy. Whether we can pull it together and make it happen in real life, it would just depend on whether we had a critical mass. But I think it's a great suggestion, just because we know that antibody plays a role in the eradication, so there's a strong rationale. Absolutely. Great idea.
This is just for the CPAP. I think there's a new CPAP machine that goes right under your nose, more like an oxygen. I don't know.
Oh, well, one, I'm sorry, was she done?
Please go ahead.
Okay. I'm just thinking, as she's saying that about the oral, taking the oral pill for C. diff, why couldn't you do it like an enema, where it wouldn't have to bypass the stomach? Do you know what I'm saying?
No.
You went
too fast for me.
Okay. Why couldn't you put it up the rear?
Oh.
Rather than having it pass through.
Well, now I understand why I missed that.
Okay.
And
I've got it.
Well, I would rather take a pill than have a suppository, but So there have been studies on survival of immunoglobulin past gastric acid. A good bit of it does get digested, but some does transit the GI tract. And I would imagine, with no data to support this, that if you're on an antacid, that that helps the immunoglobulin survive. So there actually has been a beautiful study looking exactly at what happens to oral immunoglobulin as it goes through. And it does survive, some fraction of it does survive the passage through the stomach. One more question before we move on.
So I just wanted to say on the C. diff in the oral, so my daughter did have a case of C. diff, and that was going to be our next step, but we were able to finally eradicate it with some about 12 weeks of oral vancomycin.
That's
but that was, yeah, I mean, it was a recurrence, so that was going to be our next step, was to try it, but we thankfully didn't have to get to that point.
Yeah, whew, 12 weeks. Many of you probably know that the strain of C. diff that's circulating right now is much more potent than the old C. diff, so we're seeing a lot more C. diff than we did in the past, and much more importantly, much more difficult to eradicate. Much more difficult to eradicate across the country, but especially so in immune-deficient people. So it has become a bigger problem, and I think your idea of looking at oral immunoglobulin as a treatment adjunct, I think, certainly is meritorious. So we're going to switch now to our fourth topic, which is prophylactic antibiotics. I promised that we would end with one that I thought everyone could connect to. So Terry Halper is going to summarize the thread, and Lisa Kaprinsky is going to provide a little context, and then we'll open it up to patient experiences as we've been doing.
The high level summary is, does it work? It depends. What does it depend on? Well, there's a limited number of people participating in the thread, and I'll summarize what they said, but that's exactly why we need your participation in PI Connect. It's the more you have telling us what your experience is and what works and doesn't work, we'll know better who it works for and what it depends on. But to summarize, in the thread, some patients report it depends on their environment, whether they live in a smoggy area or a clean area. Some patients report it depends on the season, whether or not they need prophylactic antibiotics. Others report it depends on underlying conditions, and sinusitis or bronchitis, can I understand that? Yeah. Some patients believe it depends on whether they're on IGIV or sub-Q.
That's interesting.
Where sub-Q users don't feel they need prophylactic antibiotics as much because some will level out IG levels. And IGIV users report more need for prophylactic antibiotic use. Some people report situational. They went through Hurricane Katrina, and although they didn't usually use prophylactic antibiotics, they used it in that situation for several months, and that was helpful. So, again, like so many questions, it depends. There's a big variation, and the more data we have about you and us, the better chance of knowing what's going to work for who.
Thank you, Terry. Before Lisa speaks, I want to give a shout out to Chris, because Chris runs those surveys. So if you participated in a survey, first of all, thank you very much.
No,
and
all I do is I am the survey monkey. I sit there and I type in front. You guys are the ones you should be clapping for. You're the 1,500, the 1,600, the 1,700 people who answered these things to help us. So it's not for me. That applause is for you. So thank you.
Chris is being a little modest. He's actually the brains behind the survey. So I just wanted him to get credit, because I think that these surveys have been the way that we've garnered information, and we hope to sort of roll some of that into PI Connect. But the surveys have actually been really instrumental in helping us understand what the issues are and where IDF needs to put its resources. So I just want to reassure you all that the information that comes from this is being used, and we're actually really grateful for your feedback. So with that little detour, I'm going to turn it over to Lisa Kaprinsky now. Of course.
There's so many different ways you can approach it. And talk about them like they are, they are all going to have a different viewpoint whether they are. Even though then the patient can be doctor and generalist, and nobody agrees about that. So how do you decide? So what should you do? Well, there's a couple of very simple basic principles that I think most people are going to agree on. The one is that there are some immune deficiencies like IgG deficiency, like primary illness disease, where we don't use them well as a prevention measure. So we have to rely on antibiotics to prevent infection. We really don't have a good alternative to treat those diseases. In the case of primary illness disease, yeah, sure, we can cure the transplant line, but otherwise, they say I'm going to take antibiotics all the time, and that's part of the treatment. Those are pretty much no brainers. For the people who have antibody deficiency, I think a large number of people at some point in their life end up on a period of prophylactic antibiotics. So what's the reason for putting somebody on prophylactic antibiotics? Well, obviously you're treating infection, but it needs to be really bacterial infection, right? Because antibiotics are bacterial infections, not fungal, not viral. And it's kind of helpful if you can identify sinus infections, ear infections, chest infections, because otherwise it's a little bit like this, you know, trying to pick up grains of sand off the floor, because, you know, there's so many different bugs out there. If you're not finding the therapy, it's something that we discuss. So the way that I approach it is to look at the patient and listen to what are they telling me about the kinds of infections they have. How often are they? Where's the sign of infection? The age of the patient makes a big difference. The child is going to be nervous and adult and someone who is over 65. That's very important. The other thing that's very important is what does it look like in your community? So I'm going to look in Georgia. We have a very high rate of antibiotic resistance for our strep pneumonia. Strep pneumonia causes a lot of infection in the sinuses, in the chest. So we take that into account when we decide which medicine is going to use for a foot loss. Usually you can get information like that from the CDC's website. So if your doctor doesn't know what it looks like in your community, you can find out. You can go to the CDC and you can look at their website, and there is a part in there under there, the infectious disease surveillance, that often will tell you if there's a high rate of resistance. They can treat influenza. If you want to know if there's influenza in the past, what strain is, you go there, and it will tell you objectively what is. So those things are very important, very helpful. The other thing that makes it very difficult is that people don't tolerate certain antibiotics. I mean, a lot of people have birth allergies. And there's certain antibiotics that just give you a lot of problems. I'll get into things about stuffing the stomach, or your dermatitis, or your stomach. So it gets very painful. You have the knots are getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and small. So it takes a lot of time to kind of come up with a plan. Is there a right way to do it? I don't think there is. I don't know what it is. I think there are very different ways of doing it. I think the main important thing is to make sure that whatever you're taking is targeted to what your issues are and take into account the patterns of antibiotic resistance that are in your community. And that's the main thing. So ask me, am I going to be able to use my antibiotics? Well, no, you're not, because your bug's fine. So you need to take that into there are other problems with the antibiotics, fungal infections. So if you knock out all the bacteria, you tend to get overgrowth of candida and other fungi. I think all my patients are complaining of antibiotics, they probiotics. What's the right probiotic? I don't know, you can ask everybody here, I'm sure you'll get different answers from everybody. I think there's not no study as to what's the best probiotic. But I think it's an important consideration to think about taking probiotics and when you're on antibiotics.
I know there's going to be a lot of questions. I just want to ask Sergio, who came in late. This is Sergio Rosenzweig. When I'm trying to think about prophylactic antibiotics in an individual patient, presuming it's not CGD or one of the specific patient groups that Lisa called out, I sort of have in my head an equation. It's an imperfect equation, but if someone's getting 5 or 6 courses of a high-power antibiotic like Levaquin or Augmentin a year, then I tend to think that they're at risk for developing resistance, and maybe that risk is higher than if they took a low dose of antibiotic every day. Just want to make the point that this bacterial resistance is something of our own making, not us in this room, but us on the planet. the bacteria become resistant because we're using a lot of antibiotics. And so balancing the risk of resistance versus the benefits of the prophylactic antibiotics is actually a really hard equation. So Sergio actually thinks about this quite a bit. So I wonder, do you have in your head, do you have a sort of way that you approach when does the risk of resistance of treating each infection individually versus an everyday antibiotic, when, how do you make that assessment, specifically from the perspective of resistance? You have to speak a little louder.
So at a given age, we think you have a lot of patients in the disease, then we have the lab change that we're giving in the population that has been tested, which was the effect of prophylactic antibiotics. We don't have that lab change in that case, but with the CDC, we have done a prospective study to know if the prophylaxis is going to work or not work. And we proved that it works. So giving all the patients antibacterials and antifungals clearly works. And then we ask ourselves the same question that Kate said. So do we see a lot of resistance? And we don't see that much resistance. So we know that patients that come to us from our pulmonologist colleagues, they usually take prophylaxis. And we don't usually do that because we don't think that this is necessary. So we keep the same prophylaxis. And whenever the patient is overwhelmed with the infection, we change, and then we go back to the prophylaxis that they were having before. So generating resistance is not something that we see data in our population. I'm asking your question, I'm just answering what I want to answer.
And I trusted you. So we're going to take a few questions from the audience, but please don't leave because at the end we're going to take a very important vote about some next steps that Chris is going to walk us through. So we have a question.
Our 8-year-old has issues swallowing pills, but he's getting to be so big that the amount of liquid he needs is ginormous. What kind of a therapist could we find to help him do that? Is that an occupational therapist, or how could we help him?
Yeah. Or some institutions will have child life, and they'll sort of have some exercises so you can get to a point where you can swallow. It's not unique to your son. Really common.
And you can go to an occupational, I don't, but that is something that occupational therapists will do. They can help you with that.
One seat away.
My question builds on a comment that Dr. Paris made earlier about inflammatory markers. I've had a number of them tested, and the classic ones like CRP and TNF-alpha have been within normal limits, but then other things like eosinophil cation protein and C4A have been highly and persistently elevated. But I'm not really sure. I mean, it validates my symptoms, and so it helps me feel like, okay, I'm really feeling what I'm feeling. But it doesn't seem to be very actionable. I don't know where to go with it, how to follow those tests up with more investigation. I'm wondering if you have any advice.
You said it. You own it.
That's a good question. So we use it in individual patients for specific situations. And so we know how to follow up. In your case, it seems a little more complicated because you said you have NK cell deficiency. So how that would play into the development of the inflammatory markers may be different than the way an antibody deficient patient may develop inflammatory markers. Because I know you mentioned you're not sure why your NK cells are low or have low function yet, right? So depending upon what the defect is, that may actually impact the development of inflammation or the immune response. So that would affect the
All right, so I think we have time for one more question. I apologize, I'm going to encourage everyone who's already in PI Connect, have other questions, please put this on the PI Connect research forum. If you have other questions, I encourage you to please consider joining PI Connect through the EPHR, which just so happens to be we're registering people outside of the registration area, big old kiosks. For our last question, I have some closing comments and a request for you.
Hi, I also have NK cell functional deficiency. I was diagnosed about 12 years ago. One of the very first people that had it in the U.S. And 12 years later, I'm seeing it come up more and more There's now a group of people that have a lot of kids with NK functional cell deficiency. And I'd like to know, after 12 years, when is our time coming that somebody is going to come up with a treatment so I don't have to sleep 18 to 20 hours a day and qualify finally for some IgG therapy?
So I don't have an answer for that, but you'll be pleased to know that there's an active research program on NK deficiency at Baylor and Texas Children's. So you're right, this is a an area that has probably been underserved by research, but Jordan Orange runs a program to try and, one of the, Jordan Orange runs a program at Texas Children and Baylor to try and understand the etiology and the best treatment for people with natural killer cell deficiencies. It is a heterogeneous group, so I don't think it's going to be one answer for all patients, but I think that it is starting to get the attention that it deserves, and I understand your frustration. But rest assured that there is some positive news and there is some movement in that area, so I'm grateful that you brought it up. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Chris, who's going to take a quick vote.
Yeah, so everyone should have, or have received, or hopefully maybe you're sitting on one, a piece of paper here. So this is our opportunity to drive some content for PI Connect. So whether you're in PI Connect now or not, we're giving you this opportunity to feel what it's like to be a patient researcher. So we had a very successful webinar last October that was run, and if at the very bottom in the italics, you can see what it covered. So we're not going to allow you to vote on that, so it's not a repeat, although it is available and recorded online. So as long as it's not any of the things in italics, what I would like you to do is please have a pen, if you do not have one, and circle one of either the four options we have there for you already, or there's an other, if you have a different idea for a webinar you'd like to see on PI Connect, please write that in. What we're going to then do here is you guys drive, you're the nomination process. We're going to whittle that down to the top two or three, whatever they are. And then sometime to this afternoon, we're going to open up the vote to our entire community here and even online, a quick survey to take it to vote on what the next webinar topic for PI Connect will be. All right? Any questions? Are we all clear? Awesome. Please go ahead and nominate your top choices. Everyone, and even the folks up here, are other researchers too, please participate.
And while you're filling that out, I just want to thank the panel discussants today for monitoring the threads. I definitely want to thank the Physician Engagement Committee that's helped to keep these threads moving along. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for being willing to take this journey, which was a little bit of an experiment. I think it actually worked really well, and I'm grateful for your input and feedback, which was hugely valuable. I personally learned a lot today, and I pledge to you that we're going to translate this into something positive. So thank you very much, and I would say give yourselves a round of applause.
Thank you.